Hey, welcome back to Talknosis, the web's only podcast and YouTube show about esoteric religions, spirituality, Gnosticism, magic, the occult, mysticism, meditation, and whatever else we feel like talking about.
Are we really the only?
I think so. Yeah, I haven't checked.
Oh, okay. I want to know about my colleagues' scholarship. Yeah, it's always good to hear to get that kind of verification around here.
Yeah, I'll look into it, but I'm pretty sure we're the first and the only. I'm Deacon Donovan Stewart, live from Nova Scotia, currently in quarantine. That wonderful voice that you heard and the person next to me on screen, if you're watching this on YouTube, is Bishop Lady Peterson, live from Chicago.
I am. Still alive.
Yep.
I am still,
yeah.
That should be the new intro. Nasty Space is turning into a real achievement.
Exactly. Still alive from Chicago, still alive from Nova Scotia, and now still alive, we have the futurist 12 years in the future. We got Dr. Tim Mansfield. I can't remember which order it's supposed to go. Hopefully you talk Gnosis heads. I haven't thought of a good name for our fans yet, but hopefully you Gnostic heads out there are probably quite familiar with Bishop Tim. This is his, I think, fifth time on the show.
Yeah. Very popular.
Yeah, four? Yes, exactly. Extremely popular. Today we have a very exciting topic, integral theory, not to be confused with integralism, which turns out is a right-wing Catholic theory that the Catholic Church should run government. So no, very different.
Yes.
Yeah, might be a show on at some point.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Sure. And there is a bunch of trad calves tuning in right now who are very disappointed. So sorry about that, but please donate to our Patreon.
Hey, and we'll... If it's not a key, that it's not a clue that they got a girl bishop on here.
Yes.
Ought to be a clue that they may be tuned into the wrong channel, but we'll work on those keywords in the future.
Precisely. So, integral theory. Bishop Tim, we've talked about integral theory before. I've been hearing about it for as long as I've been involved with spirituality. I still have no idea what it is. I don't understand. Please help me to understand.
Help us, Bishop Tim.
So, it's not weird that you don't understand. I mean, it is. I was into integral theory for several years before I got involved in the AJC. So what is kind of weird in a way is that for the entire time that I've been with the church, I've never done a conclave talk about it. I've never written anything about it. I've never said anything on Talknosis about it ever. So it's kind of weird, right? It's like my secret. It's my even more secret, even more underground interest than Gnosticism, which is saying something. So integral theory means slightly different things. Not only is it not a traditional Catholic thing, it's also not, we're not talking about the mathematical theory of how to handle increasing functions, just also, it's not that either. A lot of people associate the term integral in this sense with an American writer called Ken Wilber. And that's certainly kind of how it's become very well known in the last decade or so. But I think it's useful to trace the history and the heritage of the concept of an integral stage or an integral phase or an integral movement further back into the early 20th century, because there's a kind of a heritage to it, and that kind of helps ground it and make it a little less... it's still pretty peculiar, but a little less peculiar than it might otherwise seem. So integral as a term in this sense means a way of looking at the world and trying to make sense of things that accounts for all the different realms of knowledge, all the different senses of investigation, all the different ways of understanding self, community, culture, nature, etc. Right? So sometimes that turns into a kind of theory of everything kind of idea. It doesn't need to be necessarily a theory exactly. It's more a perspective on how to look at the world. Wilber wrote a paper a while ago that I've found helpful because it steps back from his actual, he's got a kind of a fairly specific theory, more accurately a meta theory, because it's a theory about theories. called Arkwell that he's been talking about and writing about for a bunch of years. But to kind of step back from his specific meta theory, he has this nice paper that talks about three principles that are helpful for an integral approach. And I think that's a good way to come about it. So if what you're trying to do is try to make sense of, you know, in the realm of spirituality, various people make claims about, let's take something as comparatively simple and as comparatively well understood as meditation.
Okay.
If you're a Buddhist, then your tradition will make specific claims about what the right kind of meditation is, what the outcome of meditation is intended to be, what happens to you when you meditate, what stages that meditation might go through, how you are to go about doing it, and so on. Okay. If you're a Christian and you're grounded in, say, a Benedictine tradition, maybe you're a Trappist monk or nun, so you're grounded in a specific tradition of meditation in the Trappist tradition, your tradition will also make a whole bunch of claims. And those claims might not be the same as, there's similarities, but they're not exactly the same as the Buddhist tradition. So right. Given that you seem to be doing more or less the same thing, and you're trying to bring these two, you know, so a Trappist nun and a Buddhist monk sit down together over dinner at a conference at the Parliament of Religions or something, and they start talking about meditation, and there's a bunch of things that they're saying that are similar, and a bunch of things that are different. What is one to do? How do you make sense of that? Okay, so that's a certain dimension of it. But with meditation, it gets broader than that. So these days, neurologists make a whole bunch of claims about meditation and what it is and what it isn't and what it means and what it does to you and which things are significant and what's the best way to go about doing it. Physicists make a whole bunch of claims about meditation, right? Regular medical doctors will make a whole bunch of claims about meditation. These days, psychologists make a whole bunch of claims about meditation. And some of the things that a Buddhist monk might think are significant, a psychologist might not, or a neurologist might not. Some claims try to override other claims. So just in this one thing, there's all these different realms of investigation that are trying to make sense of what goes on in this human activity we call meditation. Of those things, what are significant, what are meaningful, and what should be paying attention to. So what do we do about that, right? Mm-hmm. So what I've just said about meditation is true of pretty much anything, right? All over human activity, we've got different disciplines and fields trying to make sense of everything. We've got different traditions that are coming into encounter with each other and trying to make sense of each other and trying to make sense of themselves when seeing themselves reflected back from each other, right? Christians trying to make sense of themselves with respect to Islam, Muslims trying to make sense of themselves with respect to Christianity and Buddhism and Judaism and Jainism and Sikhism and whatever, right? So that encounter isn't new. And there are older ways to try to make sense of things. You know, there's the old, there's many paths, but they all lead up the same mountain to the same peak. Many paths, but a single truth. And that is useful to a point, but a couple of hundred years of trying to look at what these encounters mean, just in spirituality, shows that I think those sorts of aphorisms are sweet, but not particularly helpful in terms of trying to understand how things connect to each other. Right. So integral as a broad inquiry is what do we do about that? How do we make sense of it? So Wilbur's got three essential principles that he thinks are helpful. One is non-exclusion, which is that if you've got two things, you shouldn't just write one thing over with the other thing and say, we're right, they're wrong. Okay, so it's the basic principle that there's some truth to everyone's deal.
Okay.
So you can't adopt an exclusive, exclusion is not a helpful principle for integration, fairly obviously. So you've got to have some way to put things in a comparative place to each other and work out how they connect and where they differ and which differences are significant. The second thing is it's a slightly awkward word, unfoldment. And that's the idea that things unfold in a process through time. And so sometimes when you look at things at one stage of their unfolding and things at a later stage that they're unfolding, they can look quite different. And those are interesting differences because what's happening in that process is a process of development and change that's significant in the unfolding of the thing. So 20th century chemistry shares some similarities with 15th century chemistry, but greater complexity has unfolded itself in the process of understanding chemistry.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep. And various theories have been taken up and dropped in that period. And it's important to work out kind of where you are in that sequence of the thing unfolding. So that happens, that process of unfoldment happens everywhere. It happens in individual people and cultures and disciplines and whatever. And then the third principle is enactment. Knowing stuff is great, but it's not very useful unless you know how to repeat the process of gathering that knowledge is one aspect of it. But the other crucial aspect of enactment, and this is still quite controversial in some areas, the world isn't simply given to us. We encounter the world and we make sense of it through a process of applying our cognitive structure to it, of engaging in certain behaviors to let the world or phenomena disclose themselves to us. So the process of knowing is an active process of interaction with the world. We enact a knowledge process to discover things about the world. So that's new after Kant, right? Like that's Immanuel Kant and successors. Prior to that, we just assume that the world's just there and we just take it in and that's the process. But Kant's realization and then the, you know, pretty much that entire school of thought after Kant kind of accepts that the world is, our knowledge of the world is an inactive knowledge. We perform various behaviors and that helps us see. And those behaviors can be inner behaviors, cognitive behaviors, or they can be interactive behaviors. So that's how you go about doing integration, right? So that's the kind of the, all integral theories kind of in some sense share those three sorts of principles in different ways. And Wilber's meta theory is one integral theory. There's other thinkers that have had other goes at it. So there's three sort of giant figures in the 20th century. I think that the first one's Aurobindo Ghose, Sri Aurobindo from India. He was a Indian nationalist, got arrested, got jailed, had a spiritual awakening in jail, and then went, right, enough of politics, and went off and founded an ashram, invented a thing called integral yoga, so a way to bring the whole human being into being, and wrote two really significant, he wrote a lot of books. I think this, the collected works of Aurobindo are 37 volumes or something, but two made it big in the outside of India, The Life Divine and The Synthesis of Yoga. So The Synthesis of Yoga is about integral yoga, and The Life Divine is about his idea of how human consciousness is unfolded through a series of stages through time. And he paints a picture of the future unfolding of human consciousness. He's massively influential. So that influenced people like René Guénon, various other people in the West, hugely influential in India, you know, massive figure in Indian philosophy, debatably the most significant figure in Indian philosophy in the early half of the 20th century. So that's Aurobindo, step one. Step two, so he's the first person to use integral in the sense that we're talking about, that there's a new phase of human consciousness unfolding. So this is the second, one meaning of what integral means is it's this endeavor of trying to accommodate human knowledge systems. Mm-hmm. The second way that people use integral is as a different mode of consciousness that's able to not simply be embedded in its own stage of consciousness, but to be able to bring head, heart, and belly together to understanding prior stages of consciousness in an intimate and familiar way. So to have a deeper empathy with everyone, no matter what stage of consciousness they're at, which is that's the sense in which Aurobindo really initiates it. So he's followed by a European called John Gebser, who's born in, at the time, Imperial Germany, but what's now Poland. in 1905. So he's had a fascinating life, traveled all over the place, met lots of people, wrote more than a dozen books, but he has one big hit outside of Germany, and that's Ursprung und Gegenwart, which is translated in English as The Ever-Present Origin, which is legendarily beautiful and difficult as a book. So Gebser's really responsible for talking about integral as a cultural stage that from his point of view, so he's writing, most of his significant stuff is mid-century, 20th century, sort of 1940 through 1960. He died in 1973. So he's painting integral. A lot of his concerns are about not so much the development of the individual, but the cultural and social development of peoples and the stages that we go through in terms of understanding the world. So he's the first person to kind of say, so we sort of begin, human consciousness begins at an archaic stage, pre-linguistic archaic stage. With the acquisition of language, it moves to a magical stage where we understand that we've got a relation to the world, but our relation to the world isn't primarily that our understanding of agency is this kind of oblique kind of understanding of agency. I'm not going to explain this very clearly because I find GIFs are quite hard. Magic stage followed by the mythic stage, which is largely about stories, gathering together, unity, stuff like that. Let's all, you know, follow the same myth and it's all good. So both the archaic, the magic and the mythic stage, Gebser talks about as unperspectival. So it's prior to the discovery of perspective, of we haven't really understood three-dimensional space yet. And then something remarkable happens. He traces it to a poem by Petrarch, kind of standing on a mountain and looking out and kind of seeing depth almost for the first time. So there's a moment in European art where before it, everything is flat, and then after it, people start painting and drawing with perspective, as though depth suddenly becomes visible to them. They suddenly start seeing in a different way. So that's the emergence of the mental rational structure in human consciousness. So Gebser is talking about, I'm falling into a common error and talking about these as stages of unfolding. He's talking about it as structures of consciousness that are growing in an individual human being and in culture, kind of as one kind of metaphysical object, if you like. So the mental rational stage is what we've known, really. That's European culture, Western culture, if you like, and everywhere else, right? Like it's kind of growing universally all over the world over a similar period from sort of 1500 through to now. So Gebser foreshadows in the mid-20th century the development of something he calls the integral stage. So the integral stage is a structure of consciousness which creates a situation that he calls diaphaneity. So the translucence, the ability to kind of see through the current structure, the current situation, back to prior situations, so that time and history start to become visible to us in the present moment. Whereas previously in the mental rational stage, we're locked in our own present time and previous stages are kind of ignored. That's not what we're doing. We're doing this thing. But in the integral stage, we're not just locked in present time, the time of the past and also to some extent the time of the future begins to become translucent to us and all of it's present in the current moment, which is disruptive.
Right.
And if you look at global culture, really, not just in the West, but everywhere in different ways, modes and forms, sort of from 1940 through to now, and I said to you, would you say that time is, you know, that period is characterized by this co-presence of all of history and the sort of weird foreshadowed presence of the future in the present moment? Probably most people would agree that that is not a bad way to characterize what's been going on.
Yeah.
And so for Gebser, the growth of that structure is also growing inside us. And so we're developing an individual and shared capacity to be able to engage in that. But that's happening to us at different rates and stages.
What comes to mind, Bishop Mansfield, as you're describing this, is we often speak in Gnosticism, and this is coming from classic ancient Gnosticism, is the idea of different levels of understanding, the hylic, the psychic, and the pneumatic. And our colleague, Monsignor Scott Rauschbach, will even say that those three things are present in us all the time. It's not like necessarily a linear stage of development. It's something that's in us all the time. So when you were discussing this, it was just that particular paradigm came up for me.
Yeah.
I immediately resonated.
Absolutely resonates. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So, and Gebser is the same. Like Gebser talks about these as structures of consciousness because for him, all those structures are always present in us at every stage, right? So as we move through history, first, you know, the dawn of humanity is characterized by the development of the archaic structure. And then through that and enfolding it, this is the unfolding thing, right? Unfolding and enfolding, right? So we're then also enfolded in a magical structure. And then the magical structure is enfolded in a mythic structure. The mythic structure is enfolded in a mental rational structure. And then the mental rational structure becomes enfolded in an integral structure. And the particular gift of the integral structure is the ability to see through the prior structures to the earlier stage. So all of it becomes simultaneously present to us, which goes, yeah, so it's interesting. So in terms of hulic, psychic, pneumatic, right? So it's not identical. It's no. It's poetically similar.
it resonates.
Right. It totally resonates. So the sort of magic and archaic structures you could kind of say are mostly concerned with physicality, survival, you know, mm-hmm. Prey, you know, food and looking after the kin. The mythic and mental structures are more psychic because they're about the content of the mind. Mm-hmm. All right. So stories initially, and then the sort of rational perspectival view. Mm-hmm. And then the integral structure you could kind of say is either, well, the integral structure is, let's say, the beginning of a pneumatic view, and perhaps there's structures after that that have yet to be disclosed. We don't know. So that's if you want to fold the Hylic psychic pneumatic thing, Hulic psychic pneumatic thing, sort of into history in a way. And okay. I think you can kind of do that. So the good thing with, I'll get to Wilbur in a sec, because the good thing with him is he kind of adds a lot more sort of useful distinctions and nuance to this, because he spent 30 years kind of going, yeah, but how does it really work though? Gebs is a European, he's European, he's a poet and a philosopher, right? So he's concerned with depth and richness and the way this speaks about art and culture, and it's beautiful stuff. You can read a lot of Gebser, and it's very difficult to make you have to read it multiple times to make sense of it. I really recommend the work of Jeremy Jordan, by the way. I want to give him a shout out in this. He's got a podcast called Mutations, and he's the president of the Jean Gebser Society, and he's been doing a lot of work in the last 10 years to try to make sense of Gebser for other people. So I owe whatever I understand of Jean Gebser to Jeremy, really. Maybe we can include a link to him in the show notes after, but
sure.
Yeah, he's written a lovely book called Seeing Through the World, which is a short little sort of summary of some key ideas from Gebser that I think is really worth reading.
Okay.
Well, let's stay so and oh yeah, Wilbur. Yeah. So how does Wilbur make this?
Where
I wanted to go. You read my mind. Cool. How does Wilbur make this more digestible? How does he break it down? How does he add to it and transform it?
Yeah, totally. Okay. So Wilbur's Ken Wilbur. He's born 1949. He's still alive today. He's an American. Philosophers tend to resist characterizing him as a philosopher. It's debatable. Personally, I'd place him within a particular school of American pragmatism as a school of thought, in terms of his approach to doing thinking and thinking about thinking. I think he is a philosopher. He's not an academic philosopher. So he has absolutely no credibility in the discipline of philosophy as it's constituted in academia, legit. Nevertheless, he is doing a thing that you'd refer to as philosophy. He's thinking about thinking and how we make sense of the world. So I guess professional philosophers would probably argue he's just not doing it very well, but that's a, you know, matter of opinion. It's undeniable, though, that he's been writing since the early 70s, initially in kind of spiritual stuff, then transpersonal psychology. He spent quite a while writing sort of within the discipline of transpersonal psychology, and then in 95, he released a book, big fat book called Sex, Ecology, and Spirituality, which is a cracker of a title, you got to admit. And it's really good for holding doors open.
well,
in multiple senses, it's a very thick book, but that really broke out of transpersonal psychology because he's really saying there's stuff here, not just to say about the way we think and feel and are, and not just about spirituality, but actually the whole shebang. We can start to be talking about the ways all of human consciousness, perception, and all of our endeavors all cohere in a particular way. So he, in that book, launches this meta theory that he developed, he calls AQUAL, AQAL, which I'm, you know what, there's tons of summaries of that online, and if I talk about that, we're going to be here till, you know, 1:30 the hour, so let's not do that. But he particularly pulls out a little set of things that I think are helpful. One thing with respect to what you were asking, Lainey, is he pulls out the distinction between, so Gebs is talking about structures, Wilbur really wants to talk about unfolding stages of development. So in the earlier works, he calls that levels and talks about it as a kind of vertical development. And he does that tactically, I think, because he takes a similar attitude to this as Jean Piaget, noting the cognitive development of children. later stages in a child's cognitive development are better. It's not to say that a child at a later stage is a better child in some way, but a child at a later stage of cognitive development is better because they're able to see the world in a more effective way than a child at an earlier stage. Most parents will agree with that. It's not that you love the older child better than you love the younger child, or that the older child is more worthwhile in some way, but their way of seeing the world. So there's that classic experiment where you take a tall, thin glass and you fill it up with water, and you get a short, fat glass and you pour the tall, thin glass into the short, fat glass, and you ask the kid, which one has more water in it? And up to a certain age, kids will go, the tall, thin one, obviously. And then something happens and you do the experiment again and they go, you're crazy. It's the same amount of water, right? Mm-hmm. So something has shifted in the child's ability to understand the world.
Yeah.
Something fundamental has shifted in the child's ability to understand the world. That's interesting. But what's more interesting to me is the older child is unable to recall that they ever thought another way.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you show them a kid responding the other way, if you show them a video of themselves responding the other way, they won't believe it's real.
Well, you know, I think about the times you, and this is something that our generation has had the advantage of, people who are younger than us even more so, in that they can go back and they can see more videos of themselves as kids and their behaviors at various times. Back in the day, you might have gone back to your old diary or journal and read stuff and thinking, you know, what was I thinking? And I think the question may also just be, what was I back then? Because right. There's clearly been a shift in being.
Who was that person? It doesn't make any sense to me.
I don't know right. Who this person is, even though we inhabited the same body.
Totally. Yeah. So it's very difficult for most of us to empathize with people that are at an earlier developmental stage than ourselves. Or even, yeah. As you say, even ourselves at an earlier developmental stage. And we find it very difficult to feel any empathy for a society as a whole that's mm-hmm. clearly operating from an earlier stage. You know, when we look back at our own society 100 years ago and we look at the kinds of things that were considered virtue and wickedness at that time, it's not the same as the way we see things now. And it's very difficult for a lot of us to cope with that being real. We want to disown that earlier stage of our own society, just as I very often want to disown the kind of person I was when I was 20, because I was really irritating. So that's kind of normal. Okay, so Wilbur's got a bunch of neat ideas. A lot of what he focuses his attention on is kind of sorting and categorizing other people's thinking. So, because he's making a theory about theory, right? So he's trying to understand how everything kind of pieces and fits together. And what he's interested in introducing are sets of distinctions that enable you to do that effectively while preserving those three principles of non-exclusion, unfoldment, and enactment. Okay? So there's lots. We could sit here for 5 hours and I could speak without drawing breath, and I wouldn't have got to probably to a point where you could, you know, you can seriously do like year-long courses on this stuff. But a couple of the key distinctions is he's got this lovely quadrant diagram. One of the great things about Wilbur is the diagrams are really good. Gebser has no diagrams. Gebser merely has poetry. Wilbur has diagrams, which as an IT nerd, I think I found really appealing when I first encountered his stuff. So he has this neat idea of it's important to distinguish between whether you're looking at something from an interior perspective by looking into yourself, or you're taking an exterior perspective, you're looking at something out in the world. And it's similarly important to be clear whether you're talking about something from an individual perspective, from me, mm-hmm. or whether you're talking about things from a collective perspective, from us. And those are important different perspectives on how to look at a certain thing. So to go back to meditation, this is clarifying. It kind of helps you sort out when different people are writing about different things, particularly across disciplines like what's a neurologist looking at. So if a sociologist looks at meditation, they're liable to look at it in terms of like, what does it do in terms of group cohesion and social control? Right? Legit. Yeah. Fair enough. If a monk is looking, so what are they doing? They're looking at the phenomenon of meditation from a collective perspective, because they're looking at what it does to groups. And they're looking at it from an exterior point of view. They're looking at meditation from the outside. If a monk is trying to make sense of meditation, they're primarily looking at it from an individual perspective, and they're doing it introspectively. So they're looking within. If a neurologist is looking at meditation, they're putting electrodes on a person and they're trying to understand what happens to their brain. So they're looking at an individual, but they're looking at them from an exterior perspective. And similarly, if you want to look at the role meditation has played in the formation of myth and story, say, amongst Tibetan people, then you're looking at an interior perspective because it's about their stories about themselves, but a collective view.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got this neat little diagram of like individual, collective, interior, exterior. And so you can kind of group, put things into groups depending on whether they're individual, interior, individual, exterior, and so on. That's just helpful for sort of sorting things. It makes a nice little map for sorting things. And that helps you could just kind of sort theories out. The second thing I think that he does that's helpful, and it comes to that question you raised about Hulic psychic and pneumatic a bit, I think, Lainey, distinguishing between kind of he takes Gebs's idea of structures and kind of maps sort of unfolding stages over that idea and sort of, and says that, well, there's a set of structural stages that individuals and societies move through. You can pick them and they've got similarities. If you look across different people's theories, there's lots of theories that do this stuff. And when you line the theories up, there's similarities. They don't use the same number of stages all the time necessarily. If you've studied different spiritual systems, you know, there's lots of theories of the stages of the unfolding of human consciousness. Some have 7, some have 9, some have 3, some have 5. Doesn't all line up. They don't all use the same names. So one of Wilbur's books, I think Brief History of Everything, probably Sex, Ecology and Spirituality and Integral Spirituality all have these big tables at the back where they take everyone's stage theory, line them up next to each other and kind of go, see, so that stage is kind of like that one. And this one is in between those two. And those two kind of glom together, make this one. So you can kind of make some sense of the ways they all line up. So he's kind of saying this idea of moving through developmental stages is a very widespread idea. It occurs in spiritual writing in both East and West. It occurs in modern psychology. It occurs in certain kinds of anthropological thinking. It's also controversial, right? Like, so particularly, you've got to be extraordinarily careful about how you talk about the development of societies and about greater and lesser developed societies. I think a lot of that's terminological, and a lot of that's about whether some kind of intrinsic value is put on people at different developmental stages. But the reason I talked about kids and their cognitive development is to kind of point out that that's not, you know, it's perfectly possible to equally value people and societies at different stages and also acknowledge that a process of unfolding is happening and that that's a normal and natural thing, and to not kind of make that about who's worth. The trouble is the history of that kind of thinking is in the colonial project, is part of the colonial project and part of the justification of Europe's domination of the rest of the world. So you've got to do quite a lot of decolonizing work to make that make sense in a way that's helpful.
Yeah, you know, the 19th century, I was just going to say, the 19th century was really big on diagrams about the development of societies.
And so you open Wilbur and you feel like you're getting confronted with the same thing, and it takes a bit of work to kind of realize that that's not quite what's happening. But
Bishop, go.
No, I was just going to say, because I'm thinking about Christ's teachings about becoming as a little child. And as we've already acknowledged in this conversation, we don't tend to have a lot of empathy for ourselves when we were younger.
Absolutely.
It may have been in a very cute little body and we excuse it, but we don't really do that. So then I think this speaks to this conversation right here, where we know that this sort of notion of this progressive development has been used in colonial projects. It's been used in eugenics and racism and some of the worst things that have ever happened in human history. And yet I'm reminded that Jesus kind of turned that on its head and spoke of becoming as a little child. So there's some stuff here that can be worked with, even within the Orthodox Christian tradition, but also for Gnostics.
Definitely. Yeah, I think there definitely can be. I just want to pick that out because that's really important what you've just said, Lainey. The issue, what's going on there, you know, we've all had experiences, particularly if you're not a parent, right? You've been at a gathering, there's been little kids, they've been raising a ruckus of some kind, and, you know, you just want to lose it for a second. And if you walk away and you look back on what was happening, nothing dangerous was happening, right?
Yeah.
You weren't at any risk. Nothing bad was about to happen. Why were you getting so annoyed at that kid?
Mm-hmm.
What's going on? So just to kind of pull out, there's an, Wilbur introduces, he uses the word shadow. It's a Jungian word, but mm-hmm. Wilbur uses it in a slightly more specific way than Jung meant it. It's not completely part of the idea of structural development, but it's closely connected in this particular way. One of Wilbur's things to point to, and this is kind of broadly understood in certain schools of psychology, I think, as we go through this developmental process, and I want to add for Wilbur, the developmental process continues all the way to death. It's not a thing that happens to kids and you don't get fully baked at 18 when you can vote. Oh, sorry, US. 21 when you can vote. Right, you can vote at 18, but drink at 21. Weird, but no, you do.
You can join the military when you're 17. Woo! So yeah.
You're not fully baked at 17, 18, 21.
Yeah. Right.
You continue developing all the way through life. So for Wilbur and for this school of psychological thinking, partly what's going on in that developmental process is at each stage, you're acquiring things from the, you acquire things in a certain stage, you carry those things with you to the next stage, but there's also aspects of the prior stage you disown.
Yeah.
Kind of say, that's not me anymore. I'm not that kind of person. And that happens at a conscious level, but it also more importantly happens at an unconscious level.
Right.
And those aspects of that prior self at that previous stage get kind of locked away in a little box. And the gradual building of those little boxes is the development of what we're calling shadow.
Mm-hmm.
So partly what happens at that gathering when those kids are running around and being unruly and you're getting really irritated, right? If someone says, do you have a problem with children, you know, having fun? Well, of course I don't, right? But if I was raised in a certain way where I got messages from my environment that that's not how kids behave, that I had to quieten myself down, that it's not okay for me to be overexcited in groups, and that if adults are around, I'm supposed to stay very still. And I'm supposed to be very quiet and I'm supposed to be spoken to not to speak. And I absolutely did get those messages, right? So when those kids are doing that, that's triggering this reaction in me where these parts of myself that I locked away because of what I got from my environment are getting stirred up again. I can't cope with the tension that's creating inside my psyche. So I'm projecting that experience onto what those kids are doing. And I'm saying those kids are bad. Those kids are bad. Why don't those parents parent? For Pete's sake. Ugh. You know? So this idea of shadow, in a developmental context is a really crucial, interesting, and powerful idea. And I think it's a crucial thing. So there's two sort of linked things there. One is this idea of development, that we're individually going through developmental stages. And as we collectively make sense of the world around us in going through those individual developmental stages, we're creating cultural norms and cultural understandings that we share tuned to those individual developmental stages. And that's happening, what Aurobindo and Gebser and Wilbur are all kind of saying is that's all happening everywhere all at once, and it's starting to happen more quickly as we get more interconnected and we get to be able to converse with each other more globally and we get access to more ways of seeing, being, and doing. And that's a powerful and important thing, which is going on right now. So mm-hmm. something is up. So that's big, right? Because there's so much of an undercurrent in esotericism that we're in the Kali Yuga. This is the terrible age where everything is, you know, the ancient times were beautiful and amazing, and these terrible times, everything is debased and vile, and we're all sinking into poo. And so therefore, all one can really hope to do is to anchor oneself to a rock and not get swept away in the river of poo. I'm paraphrasing, but there's a lot of esoteric bloggers that I read that are more or less delivering some message along those lines. So what I found powerful about this integral tradition through the 20th century is it's realistic about the complexity of what we're going through, but it's fundamentally hopeful and optimistic that there's a way to make it through it to something which is even better than the past. Okay. But not in a naive way, not in sort of just recapitulating the 50s or something. Right. So what are we getting? This hopeful vision. We're getting this idea of individual and collective development. We're getting this idea of shadow as a developmental thing where we're owning and disowning aspects of our past. And that happens at a collective level in culture. We disown roaming around, hunter-gatherer life, right? Wandering about with no particular object a lot of the time, apart from eating, having fun, and singing songs. We pretty strongly disown that. We're not really good at accepting that as a valid way to go about your day, right? And yet, that's hundreds of thousands of years of our own history, and somehow we've decided that was a bad plan. Anyway, interesting. We also, as urban folk, disown agricultural life. That's not who we are. Increasingly, postmodern culture disowns modern life itself and the various ways that one goes about that. So what are we to do about this? So the integral view is to kind of say, is there ways of looking at all that, looking at those structures in ourselves, and then also looking at those structures as they've unfolded in history, and doing it with a sense of empathy and compassion for self and other, understanding that those are both the same thing. Wait, I feel like someone said that before. Gospel of Matthew.
Exactly.
You shall love the other as yourself, right? You shall love your neighbor as yourself.
So we're at 42 minutes, and we've gone through the first question on the question sheet.
Awesome!
So, excellent! Real well.
But this is good, though. Our last guest was like, oh, sorry, I'm rambling. I'm like, no, this is the ramble show, right? It's we want our guests to come on and ramble.
We're having a conversation.
Exactly. So I will skip ahead a little bit. So some people at home who aren't familiar with integral theory, they are hearing about the development and your examples of meditation, but they're probably thinking, like, this sounds like anthropology, like psychology, like sociology.
It's not spirituality at all, right?
Yes. Yeah. But it is my understanding that there's integral spirituality. Ken Wilber is a meditator. People talk about it as a non-dual tradition. So I'm going to get you to sort of cram in two answers here into a very long question, which is, can you talk about its reflections about integral spirituality, about understanding it as a religious system, and then can you tie it into Gnosticism or why Gnostics would care?
Exactly. Yeah, perfect. I'm very happy to. So I want to introduce one extra construct to the ones that we've already talked about, and that's what Wilber calls state stages. Okay. So it's a similar idea in the sense of a developmental sequence, but this is specifically talking about meditative states. So the ability to cultivate specific meditative states. So again, every spiritual tradition categorizes states of consciousness, and they lay them out in a sequence, pardon me. Wilber has a whole bunch of other tables where he takes Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross, and he takes St. John of the Ladder, and he takes Dionysius, and he takes Nagarjuna and Shankara and various Buddhist and Hindu Advaita systems and puts the stages next to each other on a table and goes, see, that's kind of like that. Okay. And then he boils that down to a really simple kind of set a sequence of things. If you're going to go about spiritual practice, what happens to you is disclosed to you in a groups of experiences that are clustered in a similar way. At the very beginning, most of us are able to engage in what he calls gross experiences. This is kind of TS terminology, I think, but some people say concrete rather than gross because it's not as gross, but experiences to do with the physical world, right? So an example might be Petrarch standing on that mountain, gazing out at the horizon. Most of us have done this. You stand on a mountain, you gaze out at the horizon, and you're awestruck, right? You're not seeing angels. You're not having a non-dual experience. You're just awestruck with nature, which is fantastic and beautiful and an incredibly valuable, undeniably spiritual experience, right? You're awestruck with the majesty of creation. It's all through the Bible. The Song of Moses is a long paean to God's magnificence in creation, right? It's fantastic, right? It's a legit thing. But those are concrete gross level experiences about the manifest world. Legit physical experiences, they've all got similarities because that's what they're about. That's the first thing you run across. Kids get them all the time. It's a really straightforward thing to kind of to be able to do. So then, in unfolding out of that, what he calls subtle experiences. So sorry, the concrete stuff, Lainey, that corresponds to the Hulic level in the Valentinian scheme, right? The subtle experiences are feelings, thoughts, emotions, visions, auditory manifestations, kinesthetic energy vibes from the right. So if you embark upon the esoteric path, then that's the stuff you're gunning for, right? Like you really want to, okay, great. Nature in all its a bewildering variety is fantastic. But what I really want to do is have encounters with dead ancestors and meet angel forms and hear the impenetrable primordial tune of the divine unfolding of the word and et cetera, right? So these are all subtle experiences because they're all interior. They're all, they're not concrete, yet they are kind of sensory in a way. They're a phenomenological experience of something which is non-material, but it does have content. So that's 98% of what we talk about in Western esotericism is that stuff.
Right.
Crucial and really fascinating and just mad, just wild vistas of amazing stuff to explore. So you can do that stuff for ages. So then what unfolds out of that potentially? So in causal, and again, this is sort of TS kind of Western Hinduism kind of terminology, but and so it's a bit, I'm saying all that to kind of say gross and causal, even subtle, they're not particularly intuitive as terms, but so causal experiences are fundamentally experiences of awareness as itself, mm-hmm. contentless space, soundless silence. So this is in the West, that stuff is religious mystical stuff. This is the kind of thing that Teresa talks about in the later mansions, that John of the Cross talks about in the Ascent of Mount Carmel. Marguerite Porret talks about in the Mirror of Simple Souls. It's a lot of what Meister Eckhart talks about in some of his work. So it's not generally what we're talking about in esotericism, although in Kabbalah, when you get to Ein Sof or at the kind of beyond level above the tree, that's what they're pointing to, is these kind of experiences. So causal experiences are space, awareness, and it's not characterized by content. Some people call these very subtle experiences because there's nothing there. There's just spaciousness.
Right.
So they're, of those three so far, they're the most difficult experiences to cultivate. It takes the longest time in meditation to get to the point where that stuff starts to reveal itself. If you're following a traditional path, there's different ways of configuring this, but so gross, subtle, causal, and then beyond causal is non-dual experiences where that whole scheme essentially sort of collapses and begins to interpenetrate itself. Initially, you're occupying the position of an observer, which sees all that interpenetrating. And then the observer itself collapses. So yes, that's what Bernadette Roberts is talking about in The End of Self. That's what Eckhart talks about in his stuff about indistinct union. And there's a huge literature about it in Tibetan Buddhism and Advaita Vedanta. So that's useful because it's a simple scheme to kind of say, when you're looking at when people are talking about what comes out of a spiritual practice or they're discussing spiritual experiences, where does that fit, right? So if two people are talking about experiences and they're both subtle realm experiences, then that's okay, that's interesting. And if one's talking about a causal experience and someone else is talking about a subtle experience, well, that's also interesting because that's tougher to get to and that's simpler to get to.
Right.
They're not talking from the same frame. Although sometimes people talk about subtle experiences using language that's language about causal experiences and that can get confusing. But so that's the fourth bit, right? So unfolding of states and stages, unfolding of states and stages, the bit I'm just talking about, shadow and developmental unfolding, developmental stages. And the fourth thing, hope. those are the kind of useful bits for me out of integral theory. Why bother when you're as esotericist, what in that stuff? Why not just dig into your tradition, do the work, practice? Great. That's exactly the right question, because yes, you should ignore all this stuff and you should just dig into the tradition. Where it was helpful for me was which tradition?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? How on earth do you choose? None of us gets to, you know, if you were doing this in 900 AD in a particular village, you don't get a choice. You just got what's in front of you. You've just got whatever tradition you're born into. But we have the gift and the bafflement of having access to just walking around a large North American, Australian, Canadian, or European city. You can encounter 800 years of spiritual traditions. And you can just walk in and do classes, right? And then if you add the internet.
Marketplace.
Exactly.
Yes.
A baffling, confusing spiritual marketplace full of awakened sages and shysters and all kinds of stuff, right? Like, it's mad. We were in a crazy time. So the first thing is you've got to find a tradition that you believe in enough that you can put your heart on where you can actually dig in and do stuff. So that's the first thing. I think integral as a meta theory is helpful for evaluating traditions, because what you ideally want is to have a find yourself in a tradition which has enough completeness so it accounts for the structural stage development, it accounts for state stage development, right. It understands that shadow is a thing and that teachers need to take account of it, which is comparatively rare. So
I wish it wasn't, but that's a whole other show.
So you don't want to locate yourself in a tradition. I mean, you might be in a specific organization which really only deals with the subtle stages, with psychic phenomena. That's fine if it's a specific organization. But you want to make sure the tradition goes all the way to non-dual witnessing and beyond, right? And you want to know that there's stuff in that tradition. If you're going to put your heart into it, it's got to have enough reach. So it's got to be complete. It's got to have reach. And ideally, and this is really rare, integrality. So if the tradition or the organization that you're in understands, has some grasp of all this and doesn't dismiss other traditions or other organizations in the same tradition simply because they're taking different points of view, but that it has an expansive view, an integral view that is able to see the place, all that, the place that everything occupies, and is able to say, so it's a big thing and here is where it all fits and it's all got value and place and we're still doing this part. And we understand that we're doing part of a larger endeavor and it's not exclusive. So that seems to me is valuable for how to evaluate where to locate yourself so that you can dig in and do stuff. Exactly. The second thing I think it's useful for is assessing teachers. Because if you're talking to a teacher and they're only able to give you an account of subtle phenomena, they're not able to give you an account of causal phenomena at least, or non-dual realization at its best, then they're only partially realized, then you have to understand that there's a point at which you need to find another teacher. You ideally want a teacher who's mature in the sense of those developmental stages. So if someone's only able to talk about my tradition, everyone else is an idiot, or my mode of teaching, all other modes of teaching are barren and stupid, right? They're at a certain developmental stage. Whereas if they're able to see themselves within a larger terrain of endeavor, that's a more mature attitude for a teacher. And you want a teacher who's integrated. You want a teacher who's done work on the disowned parts of themselves. They've done, and you can do this in different ways. Psychotherapy, it turns out, is quite popular. Mm-hmm. Israel Regardi legendarily commended psychotherapy to all esotericists, and I think he was onto something. And that's obviously borne a lot more fruit in the latter part of the 20th century and the early 21st. So there's a lot of spiritually compatible modes of psychotherapy that you can take on, psychosynthesis, transpersonal psychology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's lots of Zen teachers who are also psychotherapists, so on. There's lots of different ways you can pursue it. But you want a teacher who is aware that they have a shadow, who has at least begun working on the shadow and is enabled to understand that if they're having a strong emotional reaction, that's their issue and they need to go and deal with it.
Yeah.
And ideally, you want them a long way down that journey. And you can tell that because they don't flip out. They don't get unkind to people, though they may be, but they're also unafraid to be that kind of directly compassionate, you know, you need to look at this. I'm not saying that because I'm angry, and you can tell that. I'm saying that because I'm unafraid of your reaction.
Yes.
If you don't, if your teacher's unable to do that, they're not great at teaching.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's a very high bar. There's not very many people that can do that.
They need to go Bishop, to podcasting instead. And
yes. Yeah, precisely. Bishop Tim, we're actually at our limit. So
three things: evaluating tradition, assessing your teacher, and getting a reflection of what the wholeness of yourself might look like.
Okay.
So having a picture of, like, I shouldn't cease the journey until I've got my, I'm able to encompass this in my whole being, because that map tells you, as far as we understand it at the moment, how far can a human being go?
Yeah.
So as a goal state. Thank you.
Okay. So this is actually good that there's a lot left unsaid, because that means we get to do a sequel show. So we get to have you on for the fifth time, and we'll do Integral Theory Part 2 someday. And everybody at home, if you want to help make that happen, check out patreon.com/Gnostic. Your generous donations literally allow us to do the show. We can't do it without it, because we don't have any money, and we need your donations to hire the studio. 99 Perspectives, the best studio in the world. So you can sign up for as little as $1 per piece of media per month. You can also set a limit. So, you know, we want to put out more programming. Bishop Laney and I are intending to blog. We have Father Tony locked up in the vlog dungeon. We're expecting some vlogs from him. So you can actually set a limit. You can go as low as $1 per piece of media. You can do more per piece of media. And if you're on a tight budget, then you can set it at your budget per month. So if you are able to help us, you enjoy the show, you now know what Integral Theory is. I know now what Integral Theory is. This has been a great blessing. Please help us spread the light of Gnosis through patreon.com/Gnostic.
Super quick, do it. If you've watched three Talk Gnosis shows, then just sign up for a month for a buck for a while. I'm a patron. I put my donation up and down. If I'm scared about money, I put it down to a buck a month. You can't tell. No one can tell me you can't afford a buck a month. And then if things get a little better, you can put it up a little better for a while. But help these guys out. You know, they need more patrons. They're doing amazing work. They've been doing amazing work for years. And support the show.
And we're very bad high licks, so we really do need the money.
we really do. And you can also help us out by sharing the show. Share it on your social media. Like and subscribe. Leave a review. Both interact with us in the comments. Feel free to send the show to friends who might enjoy it. Just send it to them on email or through Facebook or on Twitter. I know we have some secret esotericists out there who can't post our shows publicly. I do know that you're there, so feel free to send it to a friend of yours. So thank you so much, Bishop Tim. It's been a pleasure. We look forward to part two, Bishop Laney. Always awesome. And that's it. Bye, everybody.
Take care. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to do that.